Conservative by name, conservative by nature. We conservatives don't like protests or petitions. In recent years, we've only just really begun to show our true numbers at events like the March for Life. Even though we understand that tens of thousands of lives are taken every year in abortion clinics. But you'll almost never see us organise a counter-protest, we're far too polite for that. We don't resist the constant hijacking of language by the left. We willingly cooperate when they reframe the debate with words like choice instead of abortion and marriage equality instead of homosexual marriage. On our social media, we prefer to post pictures of cats playing the piano and what we're having for breakfast instead of speaking out against injustices like deliberately killing unborn babies and deliberately designing families without one of the parents everybody naturally must have. It goes against our nature and challenges our comfort zones to make our voice heard. Take Cadbury, for example. Islam is the biggest persecutor of the world's most persecuted people group, Christians. And Islam teaches that Jesus was never crucified and certainly never resurrected. Yet Cadbury feels the need as a brand to fundraise for Islam with chocolates to celebrate a Christian holy day no good Muslim believes in. They pay a fee to certify Easter chocolates are permitted for Muslims. And the profits from this halal certification go to Islamic schools and mosques, which teach that Easter is just a big lie. Those same schools and mosques here often send donations we've helped finance to Islamic schools and mosques in Muslim-majority nations. And from there, those funds are totally untraceable. It's fair to assume those funds are often invested in fundamental Islamic agendas. Funds contributed to by Christians celebrating a Christian holy day in a culturally Christian nation for an ideology that is unrivaled for its anti-Christian history and teachings. It's time we conservatives stopped blindly dismissing the ideologies and agendas we're funding by the brands we're buying. I know ignorance is bliss, but our apathy and indifference is literally providing comfort to the enemies of our brothers and sisters internationally and our own social values domestically. It's so easy to make a huge difference by simply changing brands. Refuse to buy Cadbury until they stop paying fees for Islamic approval. It's all a big con anyway, completely unnecessary. What did Muslims eat for the 1300 years prior to commercial certification? They used common sense and had no problems. It's just a fundraiser forced upon ignorant consumers like us. Let's get into this game of consumer activism and tell the big companies interfering in Australian politics and undermining our traditional Judeo-Christian values that we won't buy from them until they butt out and simply do their job without pandering to radical fringe agendas. This is Church and State with Dave Pellow. My guest today is Stuart Ballantyne, owner of Sea Transport, which is Australia's largest shipping designer. Thanks for your time today, Stuart.
Thanks, David. Nice to be here.
It is nice to be here.
A good setting.
It is. So we're in Stuart's backyard on Sovereign Island in his boat. A ship designer should have a nice boat.
Absolutely, yes.
Tell me about Sea Transport, about the scope of the work you do.
Sea Transport started off just as a little design and survey company in 1976. I was a one-man band, and I thought, I was 29 at the time, and I thought, I'm going to be self-employed by 30, and I'll be retired by the time I'm 40. And I'm still actioning that, and I'm now just 37 for the 33rd time. So 37 was such a good year, I decided to stay there. So we started off a design, even on small boats, but I was from the big shipping industry. So we then graduated to bigger and bigger vessels, but quite innovative stuff. And we have sold our designs now to 47 countries. Mm-hmm. To sell to 47 countries, you have to visit 70 countries 10 times.
Wow.
And I did most of the door knocking in the early days.
That's a bit of travel.
It's a lot of travel, yes. I used to fill in the census form and say, where do you live? I say, Qantas.
Yeah.
And so I live on the Qantas jets. So, no, it was interesting, because, but you have to go where the fish are biting.
Yep.
And in my market, it's global.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of travel, yes.
So tell me about your decision to set up offices overseas. What were the factors that led to that?
It comes back to demand. At the moment, we're building a lot of vessels in Asia, so we have one office in Guangzhou at the shipyard where we're doing a production line of ships.
Guangzhou is a city in China?
Yes, it is.
Yes, the old Canton.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's 2 hours train trip from Hong Kong,
mm-hmm.
So it's not a hardship to get there. Or you can take a ferry for 2 hours, so it's actually quite pleasant. And then we have one office in Hong Kong and the ones down here. So we're building at the moment in China and Malaysia and Indonesia. We have built in Vietnam, all around the place. We've built.
And what are the type of customers that buy designs from you?
Just commercial ship owners, ferry operators. We design and build a lot of large roll-on, roll-off ferries.
Mm-hmm.
We just finished one for Venezuela, for instance.
A roll-on off.
So in other words, they drive the truck straight on, mm-hmm. and the buses and the cars. That one takes 100 cars and 800 passengers,
mm-hmm.
24 knots, which is about 45 kilometers an hour.
Okay.
So that runs from in Venezuela out to Margarita Island, which is a very famous island in Venezuela. But we've sold them. You know, if you go to Bahamas, for instance, all of the vessels in the Bahamas serving the island chain are all designed here in Queensland.
Now, did you tell me once that the Singapore Navy, or was it some other Navy?
The Indian Navy. The Indian Navy has got six of our vessels, and the hydrographic vessels. The Thai Navy has four.
Mm-hmm.
The Australian Navy has several. These are the non-combatant vessels. These are hydrographic survey and stuff like that.
Okay.
So, but they have to go for proven designs, and we've got a lot of proven designs around the place. So,
excellent. And what are the design features that they're looking for to have proven?
First and foremost, the ships must be a good sea handling ships. And secondly, the hull efficiency. And we do a lot of tank testing down in Tasmania. We're the biggest user of the tank test facility at the Australian Maritime College down there.
Wow.
And we've developed a series of strange shaped vessels and strange type of vessels that the market wants. This vessel, for instance, we have elliptical bulbs on it. And it runs at the same speed as most other vessels of this size,
mm-hmm.
at 1/3 or 1/4 of the horsepower.
Wow.
So when we get people out here and we bring them on board, we take them for a run and just say, well, this is...
Which would be very fuel efficient.
Oh, super.
Wow.
This is we cancel out the wave, but it's clever stuff, but we've developed these designs and we continue to sort of stay on the designs. We've sort of developed the jumbo jet or the... You know, the 777, we haven't gone to the Concorde.
Yep.
We never designed the fastest ones. We designed the most economic ones. And people
well, that's very helpful with transport.
Oh, sure. People are after economy.
Yeah.
For sure.
Now tell me, were there any economic reasons in moving your companies overseas?
Yes, there was. The payroll tax guy got on to us. And payroll taxes are fairly insidious. Anti-employment tax, I believe.
Mm.
You know, it's crazy when your payroll gets up so that you've got 8 or 9 guys and then you want to employ someone else and the government says, oh, you've got your payroll to that extent that we're going to charge you the equivalent to an extra person. So when you take on that extra person, you're actually taking on two people.
Wow.
It defies logic.
Mm.
It is an anti-employment tax. And it generates about $25 billion for the states. Even though the government years ago, when they were introducing GST, they said, "Oh, we will not have that."
Mm.
But in actual fact,
yeah, there was lots of taxes that were meant to be
gone, but
yeah.
They weren't.
Yeah.
So,
I once pointed out to a Labor senator that the Alco Pops tax was implemented or proposed as an incentive to reduce the incentive to buying alcohol.
Yes.
And that the tobacco tax was implemented supposedly as a incentive to reduce consumption of tobacco. And I asked him then, what is therefore the point of the payroll tax? To reduce consumption of payroll?
Yes.
Reduce jobs? Reduce employment?
Yes.
If that's what taxing does, reduce a market behavior,
yeah.
Then...
Dave, that is an excellent point. I have to tell you, that is an excellent, that's a good argument you should have. And I was hoping that Campbell Newman, when he was elected, I spoke to him before the election, and I said, whatever you do, be bold. Leadership is about boldness.
I think he listened to that.
No, but I mean, be super bold. And one of the things you must do, you must get rid of payroll tax, because in Australia, for instance, 96% of the companies in Australia are all small businesses. Mm. We were a small business.
Yeah.
And the small businesses, the characteristic really encompass that they're all family companies. Mm. Secondly, they're all working 80 to 90 hours a week.
That's right.
You know, they really know how to work, but they're being penalized. And what Joe Bjelke-Petersen did many years ago when he became Premier of Queensland, and he was not an educated guy, he'd left school at 12 or 13, he knew how to motivate people. So when he became Premier, after the second cabinet meeting, he eliminated death duties. Now, you might think, well, that's not a big deal, but in actual fact, it propelled Queensland from obscurity to just, it was the best state in the country.
It was the destination for everybody. Absolutely. Who was building an inheritance for a generational inheritance.
Absolutely.
Which happened to be the big employers.
Yes.
So jobs came to Queensland, so other people came to Queensland, and I think the Gold Coast was turned into a booming town on the back of the abolition of death tax, death duties.
But the fact that he was bold, and in the last 40 years when I've paid attention to politicians and to what they say, because once you run your own company, you actually start listening to what these politicians say.
Mm.
And most of it's, a lot of it's drivel, but... when you think, well, that's not right, and they're saying all the populist things, with a leader. I've only seen Joe Bjelke-Petersen, and then Jeff Kennett was the other guy. When a guy comes in, if a leader comes in, you can tell within the first 2 months he's a leader. For instance, Malcolm Turnbull that we have at the moment, he's not a leader. If he was a leader, we would have known that in the first 2 months.
Yeah.
But you get guys who, oh, we might change this and we might change that. We don't pay them to maybe do this or think about that. We actually need a leader. If you're running a company like I'm running, we have to make decisions.
Yeah.
Early and evasive action.
Yeah.
Early and evasive action. That's what we used to use at sea to avoid collisions.
Yeah.
We had to do early and evasive actions. In this country, to do early and evasive actions, we could have avoided the terrible financial state that we're in.
Mm.
But we have not taken early or evasive action.
Yeah. Yeah. So getting back to payroll tax and economic affairs in general, a lot of people would have sympathy with, or maybe empathy, with the narrative that the bigger you are and the more successful you are, the more tax you should pay. And that abolishing payroll tax would be basically cutting the people who can afford it the slack, and they'd be advocating instead lower income tax cuts. Talk to me about that paradigm of thinking and how that actually affects the battlers, the blue collar workers.
I think what you have to do is copy success. If you can show me any other country in the world that is actually doing this successfully and has high unemployment, show me. But there actually isn't anyone doing this. This is just an anti-employment tax, which actually is, it's just been there so long that they don't want to get rid of it. They've got, the state governments have got their sticky fingers on it and they don't want to let it go. That was the problem. So.
Corporate taxes, as well as payroll tax, are being discussed reduction of corporate tax at the moment. Trump is talking about a 15% corporate tax rate in America. We know Ireland and England and Singapore and other places have really low corporate taxes. What impact on Australian jobs and blue collar workers does it have for us to have a high corporate tax rate or a low corporate tax rate? Where should it be, and what's the impact on the majority of the population?
I think the problem is that we have geared ourselves against effort. At the moment, we tax effort and we reward laziness. And this, to me, is a huge mistake. You shouldn't reward laziness, whether it's in your family or your city or your nation. You should be rewarding effort. And the people that are crazy enough, like me, to go and work 80 hours a week, say, well, good on you. But instead of that, they say, oh, well, he's driving quite a nice car, and he's living in quite a nice house, and he's got a nice boat. We should tax him, you know. And this poverty, that's a poverty mentality. And for nations that want to aspire to good things, you should applaud success, not knock it down.
What about practically?
Well, practically in this country, a payroll tax is just, I mean, it's really stuck in my throat. I just detest it. And what they did, I've always tried to stay under the payroll tax with the number of people that we employ, because I just, I think it's an offensive tax.
So what you just said was that you actively avoided the payroll tax threshold.
Absolutely.
That means practically there were local Australians, skilled workers, who never got a chance to apply for a job because you made a decision totally motivated by tax minimization, by the financial numbers.
Yes.
To not employ one extra person.
That's correct.
As you said previously, if you hired that person, that one person that chipped you over the threshold
cost me two.
They might get $50,000 or $80,000, but you'd have to part with $100,000 or $160,000.
That's correct. That's correct.
Which they couldn't work hard enough to generate a profit for.
That's correct. It doesn't make sense.
When we come back, we're going to have a chat to Stuart about some innovative and bold ideas he's got for using the waterways which surround most of our population concentrations, which is on the coast. Welcome back to Church and State with Dave Pellow. This morning we're sitting down with Stuart Ballantyne, owner of Sea Transport. Stuart, you've got some really, really interesting ideas about sea transport, not your company, but the concept for Australia. We're currently talking about huge investment in rail and road in Australia. But you're saying we're overlooking the obvious in the water. Tell me more about that.
Absolutely. I've been campaigning like John the Baptist out in the wilderness for the last 25 years about coastal shipping and the advantages it has technically, commercially, and environmentally. And just recently, I've started doing a series of Australia's Maritime Transport Policy, Excellence and Stupidity.
Okay.
Now, the reason why I changed it to a sort of slightly confrontational title is that they then make me the last speaker. And I said to them the first time, I said, why are you making me the last speaker? They said, no one's going to leave with a title like this.
Maybe we should make it the title of the interview today, the episode.
Well, and I can tell you what I've done in the last few episodes that I've done of this in different places, in public forums. I always get to the lectern and I said, ladies and gentlemen, if you're offended easily or have thin skins, now is probably a good time to leave the room. I said, but before I start, I'd like to paraphrase a section out of the Old Testament of the Bible. And the land was overrun with hosts of Philistines. And I said, and you're probably all wondering what a Philistine is these days. It's the green boating, tree-hugging, ABC-watching, same-sex marriage zealots and other troglodytes that are bringing our great nation down. And I sincerely believe that. And I said, no, now that I've got your attention and we've established the political correctness.
And how much cheer do you get from that? Or no, booze?
I see everyone sitting there with a jaw down going, I can't believe they said this in this political correctness, the stupidity state that we've gone to in Australia.
Yeah.
And I said, no, to prove that we're so stupid in this country, I'm going to show you some slides that is going to knock your socks off. The first slide is a paddle steamer on the Murray River 160 years ago, powered by a 20 horsepower steam engine, log fired, okay, 160 years ago. Now this paddle steamer could at the time transport 2,000 bales of wool. And you think, gee, that's pretty impressive. 160 years later, come to today, to transport 2,000 bales of wool needs 20 semi-trailers, mm-hmm. each with a 400 horsepower turbocharged diesel. So in 160 years, we've moved from 20 horsepower for one task. For the same task, we've gone to 8,000 horsepower. Now, I'm just a dumb Scottish migrant, but that to me doesn't seem progress technically, commercially, or environmentally. And what most people don't know about the Murray River, it's actually navigable 970 kilometers from the barrage, but it's also navigable 36 meters above sea level. And remember those numbers, they're really very important numbers. Because our forefathers had lots of vision. They didn't have heavy earth moving equipment. They didn't have this and that and the other, but they also didn't have regulations, rules, green rules, green tape. But if you actually went to the other side of the country and came in at the Gulf of Carpentaria, I said, okay, well, we'll take one of those rivers and do what they did in the Murray. We'll dredge it and we'll put some locks in there and we'll go to 36 meters above the sea level. We will arrive in a place called Gregory Downs. And you think, well, where's Gregory Downs? Well, Gregory Downs is, if you go to the Gulf of Carpentaria, you'll see it down there about probably 150 kilometers in from the coast. That is in the center of 1 billion tons of phosphate, which is a locked resource. You say, well, what's a locked resource? A locked resource is stuff that you can't dig out of the ground, stick on a truck, take the truck to Mount Isa, take it on the rail then to Townsville, then stick it on a ship, or go the other way to Darwin at a price cheaper than what you can sell it for, right? So in other words, it's a locked resource. Economically, it's not even worth doing.
Okay.
So you have to change your transport thinking. So if we...
So because of the transport costs, it's not economically viable to bother with.
That's right. There is no port that's anywhere near these resources, you know? So... now you think, well, why haven't we done that? Now, at the moment, we're messing around with our focus on road and rail. Mm-hmm. I can show you the graph where rail in Europe has flatlined since 1970. You say, well, how does it flatline? It's like if you and I, Dave, have a model railway set, we can only get so many trains around the track. It's the same with pipelines. You can only get so many things through the pipeline or through the railway track, you know? So, but we have myopically focused on road and rail. And now we've got this massive $1 billion we're spending on rail. We're going with this Brisbane to Darwin and rail link and all that sort of stuff, or Brisbane to Melbourne to Brisbane. And everyone's saying rail, rail, rail. It is actually totally the wrong way to go. If I have to build a railway from scratch anywhere in this country, it's going to cost me roughly about $14 on capex per million tons. Per kilometer.
What's on capex?
On the capital expenditure.
Mm-hmm.
If I do a canal, it's $2. If I do a
14 or two?
Yeah, so, well, it's 14 for the railway. If I do a whole road, it's 10. Mm-hmm. But most whole roads at the moment are costing around about $13,000 per kilometer per annum maintenance. Why would we do that?
Yeah.
You know, and if we go back to the 8,000 horsepower on the trucks, they're also paying this enormous
fuel
cost, but they're also paying the enormous road maintenance cost.
Yeah.
So if I'm taking it over 100 kilometers, I can reduce on river travel, I can reduce the cost by 92%.
Wow.
And then when you say, well, let's come to the emissions. The emissions, I can save the emissions 96%.
Gee.
Which is really quite astounding.
Yeah.
And say, well, this is actually quite impressive.
Yeah.
Say next door to my neighbor. Now people say, well, why can't we do that? The fact is that we've tied ourselves up with rules and regulations, mainly green rules and regulations, that we actually can't get in, we can't dredge, we can't do this, we can't do that, we can't touch these mangroves, we can't do that. For what reason?
Yeah.
And it is just absurd that if there was a competition, an Olympics competition on shooting yourself in the foot, at the moment Australia would win gold, silver and bronze.
Yeah.
Because we've tied ourselves up, and the future of our kids and our grandkids with idiotic rules that are over the top, you know, with these green warming, the planet warming cultists.
Yeah.
It's just madness,
yeah.
Total madness. And unfortunately, we don't have leadership that's got enough spine to stand up to them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real shame. But in terms of using our waterways, we should be focusing on that as a transport policy. If you speak to any of the transport policy around the country, people, whether federal, state, or local, they would have no idea what you're talking about. Well, I know because I've addressed most of them over the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Terrible.
So what kind of reasons do they come up with for saying, no, we're not going to do that, that's too big, too hard? Yeah. We're worried about mangroves and dredging.
Yes, right. The green rules around our coast are really, now they have managed to lock it down. It's
okay.
A real shame.
Yeah.
They've managed to lock it down. So, and it is too hard. They can understand road and rail because, yeah, there's roads up across here and there's railways up there. They can actually get their heads around it.
What are other parts of the world doing with this? Have the Enviro-Nazis got roads and rail dominant thinking in Europe and America?
No, in fact, they've actually realized if you're serious about the environmental aspects, which they should be, this is what you should be doing. If you go to St. Petersburg, for instance, at nighttime at St. Petersburg, when all the tourists go to bed about 8 or 9 o'clock, they open up all the bridges in the city and all these barges, they move during the night. If you go to Amsterdam, all these barges are moving backwards and forwards in the middle of the tourist areas. And brightly colored and painted. And here, you mentioned, oh, we're going to move barges. Oh, no, we can't do that. That's, you know. That's
okay, so awesome. Let's talk, you tell me what time frame, 10, 20, 50 years. And tell me, over that time frame, what would the benefits be? What could we move? How much people, how much cargo?
We could unlock almost every locked resource in this country. If we actually had a...
Okay, so we can access a lot of our natural resources.
Absolutely.
What about existing transport? How many road movements could we reduce? Let's say if we follow all your, like, totally, go the whole hog. Dredging, port development, all the things that we need to do. How long would that take? 10, 20, 50 years?
Well, no. The second part of the presentation, which was, I was referring to inland waterways before, but on coastal waterways, for instance, looking at the cost, the road cost issue, we kill 1,300 people a year around the coastal roads in this country.
Mm-hmm.
At a much bigger cost and much bigger impact, social impact, is that we seriously injure 18,000 people a year around.
Wow.
18,000. And the reason I say that's a more serious impact is that families then have to look after with the wheelchairs and et cetera, et cetera. And we know because, you know, my father-in-law was a victim of a hit-and-run truck accident. So for 13 years, we were pushing the wheelchair, and it changes the whole family.
Yeah, it's kind of like in battle. If you want to really impact the enemy, you wound a soldier instead of killing them.
That's right.
Because it takes out everybody around him to support him and after him.
That's correct. So it's exactly that. So, but if you then say, well, let's look at APSTATS and road accidents, road deaths and road accidents, there's about 27 billion a year. And then you add road congestion, road maintenance, it comes to a total of 50 billion a year. Now, Europe, very cleverly, they said, well, let's do motorways of the sea. So about 20 odd years ago, they funded a subsidy to take the trucks off the road. And this is right through the Mediterranean, up around the Baltic, and all the coastal roads. Now, we really, in this country, we only have coastal roads because most people live around the coast. Mm-hmm. And we've been saying, listen, guys, we've got to emulate success.
Yep.
They did in Europe. They only had to subsidize the motorways of the sea year one. Now, in the first 2 years, they took 60% of the truck movements off the highway.
Wow.
Now, if we could,
that's
a huge number, but it's a huge saving, because if you actually look at the source of the road accidents, road maintenance, road pollution, it's actually trucks. It's not cars.
Mm.
And you're eight times likely to have a truck involved in a fatality and an accident than a car.
Wow.
It's really quite interesting. You say, well, let's focus on getting the trucks off the roads. I've stood in front of so many politicians, federal and state, and I've spoken to marine industry groups and community groups, and they go, yeah, that's a great idea. No one's got it. No one's got the...
And you're saying it's basically the Enviro-Nazis that are holding the nation to ransom?
Absolutely. Absolutely. People are also a bit terrified about the Maritime Union. And last month, I actually met with Paddy Crumlin, who's the secretary of the MUA. I did this whole presentation again on why we should be using our waterways. But I went a little bit further with him.
Surely they'd be a supporter, thinking there'd be more jobs.
Well, yes, they agree there should be more jobs, but because they've got such a colorful history of messing people around on the waterfront and ships, that no one trusts them anymore. So the only way they'll trust them is actually if they put skin in the game. And I've challenged Paddy Crumlin over the last 3 years, put some money on the table of your union money into any venture, the industry will follow you. At the moment, nobody's putting money on the table because they don't trust you. It's a real shame. So between, I'd say 80% is the Enviro Nazis have stuffed it up. And with the compliance, I tell you, of the federal, state, and local governments, because they've all got regulators everywhere, you know, that you can't sneeze without someone reporting you.
Mm.
So we have a situation that we have to sort of control.
Well, in the previous segment, Stuart told us how he answered census question on census night, where does he live? It's at Qantas. But recently he's written a letter to Qantas and to various newspaper editors explaining that he's no longer going to keep his business with Qantas because of the political interference they've decided to take upon themselves in Australian politics. So in our next segment, watch that, and we'll have a chat with Stuart about Qantas and them staying out of politics and sticking to planes. Welcome back to Church and State with Dave Pellow. We're on Stuart Ballantyne's boat, ship. How big? When do you say ship?
Really, when it's slightly bigger and it has engines running all the time, or generators running all the time.
Okay.
Roughly.
Stuart Ballantyne owns an international company. It's not super massive, but it does employ 35 people, which is a lot bigger than most. And Stuart has recently said, no more Qantas for me. Stuart, tell me why you've decided to take this path of consumer activism.
I'm just a straight dye-in-the-wool Scotsman. I just like things being plain in front of me. And when I go to Qantas and sat with Qantas for the last 40 years when running this business, I was happy about the safety and the level of service and the punctuality. I'm only interested in those three things, but lately I'm getting, you should be supporting same-sex marriage, and it's on your boarding pass now, it's on the rings of the staff, and the gay adverts in the magazine, the Qantas in-flight magazine. I am not interested in Qantas's opinion on anything apart from safety, schedule, and service, right? The three S's. Especially safety. And Qantas, actually, the brand name was about safety.
Mm.
Fully about safety. But when they're now almost championing the same-sex marriage and gay brigade, and to me, that just didn't make sense, because the partners, the major partners with Emirates Airlines, and Emirates, of course, is based in the Middle East. It's a Muslim-owned company, and the homosexuality is offensive to Islam.
That's right.
Now, if you're about the business of offending people, they quite often react, in fact, they react stronger with offense than they do with anything else. So if I get offended with you or offended with a neighbor, you know, I can get irrational. And we've already seen mildly offended Islamic terrorists at cartoons blowing the place up and executing the people. Just at cartoons. Now, you don't have to join the dots too far to say, well, hang on a minute, here's Qantas pushing the gay homosexual banner while flying into the Middle East. And even around here, we've seen acts of terrorism around the world from offended Islamic believers. I believe that they're setting, they're jeopardizing their safety.
Qantas,
Qantas are jeopardizing their safety by saying, we're for the gays, we're for the gays, and yes, as I know there's a lot of gays within Qantas, and that doesn't concern me, but pushing the barrow does concern me, because I believe you will offend some little guy who then may take a lone wolf or even an organized terrorist and say, well, okay, this is anti-Islam, so we're going to take issue with this, as they did with the cartoonists in Paris. And I don't want to be sitting at 34,000 or 36,000 feet and explode. So I've said to Qantas, I'm out, you know, because to my view, that they are jeopardizing the safety of that airline. And I think every Australian company that is saying, oh, we're going to get on the same-sex marriage, are we going to... I find that offensive, that they're trying to dictate to their passengers or the customers, oh, no, we support this. We're not interested in any company. I'm not interested. I don't peddle through my companies. I don't peddle my social beliefs to anyone who's my customer. And I think it's out of order to do that.
Right.
And I think there should be a movement about companies that do support marriage reality, for instance. The same-sex marriage has almost got a life of its own, a negative life of its own, and I'm not even remotely interested.
I like that, marriage reality.
Yeah, well, there's something that really you should almost have a register of companies that support marriage reality as opposed to marriage equality. I think you should keep yourself busy in doing something like that, Dave. Because I think there's a lot of my friends that run their own businesses, they're also not interested in the thoughts of Qantas.
We've seen many corporations actively recruited and lobbied by the homosexual lobby to join the Marriage Equality Australia movement, or Australian, whatever their proper title is. Do you think there would be many who would be brave enough to join a marriage reality movement?
I'm not so sure about that, but I think, well, you could try it, see, but I think a lot of people will vote for with their feet. I mean, we're voting with our feet with Qantas. I'm not interested in their views, especially where their views are likely to offend someone that's going to act irrationally and jeopardize my safety or the safety of my staff or my family. So, well, leave that to them. And I will, anyone else who's peddling the same line, I won't be going with them either, whether they're selling insurance or petrol or anything, I won't be going with them. You know, I'm just not interested in that and their views of same-sex marriage. It's just a crazy thing that it's spun this life of its own by almost a minority, whereas the majority are sitting quiet and saying, well, yeah. Actually, we shouldn't sit quiet. We say, okay, well, if Qantas want to do that, we don't fly with Qantas. If this petrol company wants to, sure, we won't buy their petrol. Yeah. So there should be a same sort of campaign by the sensible people in the country, and I'm sure there's a lot of sensible people. Most small businesses, for instance, I find are sensible people.
Yeah.
And they're fairly straight down the line. That's really my opinion on it.
Is it really about security fears for you, or telling Qantas to stay out of politics and stick to planes? Or is it that you're actually more uncomfortable with homosexual people?
I'm not uncomfortable with homosexual people, but I'm uncomfortable with someone telling me I should be supporting something, or you know, pressuring me all the time and on social issues. But I really do believe that they're creating a huge safety risk for the traveling public.
Okay.
You know, who would have believed that you go to the actions of a lot of these lone terrorists? I mean, some of these guys are mildly offended at the West, but if they get particularly offended about one aspect of people's behaviors, you know, whether it's adultery or we need to stone them because they've been caught in adultery, promoting homosexuality and running an airline, hello, that's a huge compromise of safety.
It's a real interesting facet of this discussion of Qantas's involvement in politics that I haven't heard anybody else raise. The security risks they're inviting by taking such a controversial position on marriage and family, especially given their international and Middle Eastern major affiliations. I've never heard anybody raise it as a security concern before.
Well, it's only when I started thinking about it, I thought, whoa, hang on a minute, these guys are compromising us. They're compromising the safety. And you won't see Qantas doing an article in the Middle East in the local newspaper saying, hey, we support same-sex marriage. They won't be doing that. They won't be standing up in the local TV station saying, hey, we support. Yep. If they do, they'd be jailed.
You included me in a copy of the letter that you sent to many editors, and we put it in an article a couple of days before we recorded this interview. And in the article that I wrote, I basically agreed with your action and said, we need a lot more conservatives to figure out how the left are changing society, because with a very, very tiny voice, they're actively leveraging social change and an agenda that most of us don't agree with. But because their voice is so loud and strong and organized and consistent and clear, they're making it seem like it's the majority position.
That's right.
And the media are buying it, and politicians are buying it, and the people who listen to media and politicians are buying it, and they're actually achieving social change because the rest of us are being silent and unorganized and inactive and happily continuing to buy from brands that actively oppose the social values that we value.
But that's interesting you say that, Dave. But as I said in the earlier segment, if there was an Olympics competition on shooting yourself in the foot, Australia would win gold, silver, and bronze. And it's the same with this. Everyone's sitting watching the whole place going to hell in a handbasket. And it's really about companies like mine and others saying, well, okay, hey, enough of this crap, guys. We should actually stand up for marriage reality. We should stand up against these large corporations saying, telling us what we should do, what we should vote for, et cetera, et cetera. It's the time actually to say, enough is enough. You know? Let's stop, you know, destroying this country. Destroying this country.
Excellent. If you'd like to be part of the consumer activism, to tell Qantas in particular to stay out of politics and stick to planes, head to churchandstate.com.au. Look for the episode and article with Stuart Ballantyne entitled Excellence in Stupidity, and find the petition there, add your name to it, and let's ask Qantas to stay out of politics and stick to planes. That's it for this interview.
Thank you.
I really appreciate the time and the hospitality on your marvelous boat.
No, my pleasure.
Thank you. If you're a partner of churchandstate.com.au, stick around, because we've got a special bonus segment for our partners that only you can see. And if you'd like to become a partner so that you can get more, better information and better insights into the people that we interview and the issues that we're talking about, head to churchandstate.com.au, where you can become a partner and help us stay a completely free and independent voice for everyone.